just occasionally, there comes along a talk which, on the face of it, sounds pretty straightforward. But then those present soon realise that they are listening to something unique, something important. Just such a talk occurred in January. Paddy Dowsett, the Business Development Director of MSubs Limited, came along to the Royal Torbay Yacht Club, where around 60 members of the southwest section of the CA were assembled. He'd come to talk about a project which was part of the Mayflower 400 celebrations, celebrations to mark the anniversary of the sailing of the Pilgrims to America in 1620. The plan was simple enough, to build a boat which would cross the Atlantic unaided. This was not to be a boat with souped-up autopilots. It would not be auto-helm on steroids. This would be something totally new and different, a fully autonomous boat, the Mayflower Autonomous Ship. By any measure, this was hugely ambitious. Paddy's background is in the Royal Navy. He was a warfare officer, specialising in communications and electronic warfare. He commanded a Type 23 frigate, HMS Northumberland, and that took him on deployment to the Middle East. He explained how this idea came about.
So some time ago, in fact it was when Tudor Evans, the present leader of the council, was in power, they started having discussions about how Plymouth and the wider region would celebrate Mayflower 400. And initially there was a thought of building another replica Mayflower, but my MD, who's a very interesting character, definitely entrepreneurial, why are we doing that? Why are we looking back? We're trying to position Plymouth and the southwest as a centre for maritime autonomy in the UK. We want to attract high-tech industries. You know, we want to look forward. Why don't we come up with a future Mayflower? So it captures the pioneering spirit. We're doing something new. We're sending a vessel unmanned into the unknown, very much like those poor souls did who stepped on board the Mayflower and then the other vessels that initially tried to accompany it. Let's capture that and send something across. Do something new that sends a message about where Plymouth wants to go rather than where we've been. So that was the genesis of the idea. Ideas are really easy, aren't they? It's turning that idea into reality. So we had aspirations to build some 30-metre carbon fibre, high-tech, completely environmentally friendly, powered only by wind and solar to cross the Atlantic. Everyone thought it was a very good idea. We're not quite good enough to give us any money to build it, which is the way of the world. At one stage, we had some form of oil and gas interest because it had been good for their corporate social responsibility policy. But as soon as the oil price collapsed, so did their corporate social responsibility approach. So we've ended up pretty much by building it ourselves. And she's in a yard in Poland. We wanted to get her built locally. There's a really good aluminium shipyard in Exeter that some of you may be familiar with, but the costs were just 4 or 5 times the order of magnitude of getting it built abroad. So we've had to go abroad really to keep the cost down because it's being funded by the company. There's no public money going into this. There's no council money. It's being funded by the MD who owns the company. And of course, the boat is just part of it. It's the brain on the boat that is of real interest. Crossing the Atlantic itself is relatively straightforward. You will all appreciate more than most that the difficult bit is getting in and out of the harbour. Once you're clear of the sort of the fairway marker, if you like, it's easy, isn't it? So once she's west of the Scillies and you're just following some great circle route, then until you reach the US side, then it really is quite plain sailing. So the challenge is developing the level of autonomy for the close-in bit. Yes, there are some challenges when you're at sea. I mean, who's doing the maintenance of your diesel? You know, diesels have 2,000 working parts. I think an electric motor has 18. So in the future, you'll see a lot more use of electric motors because it makes this sort of thing more easily. But at the moment, there's still going to be some onboard maintenance required, some form of oversight. So there are some challenges, engineering management challenges, but the greatest challenge really is getting this vessel safely in and out of harbour.
Well, that was the idea, but how to make it happen? What skills and experience do MSubs have to tackle such a technically advanced project?
We build manned and unmanned submersibles, primarily for the military, a little bit of oil and gas. We're a small company, there's 65 of us, but we are very heavily integrated. we pretty much manufacture everything on one premises. So we have a design team, a couple of technical directors who will sign off, a team of younger engineers from mechanical, electrical, electronic, software. And then at the other end of the premises, we have our own workshops, a manufacturing shop and a turning and a lathe shop. So we can do stuff very, very quickly. And of course, with any form of R&D, there's always going to be an element of error. We're not going to get everything right first time. That's what R&D is. And so, and we can do things very, very cheaply as well, which puts us at an advantage. Big companies struggle to do cutting edge stuff.
The company has an impressive track record when it comes to submersibles. They clearly have the right skill set.
One of the things we are doing is giving the Royal Navy its first extra-large unmanned system. So this is one of our previously manned submersibles. It's 9 metres long. It used to carry a crew of three. We secured a contract from the Navy to take the man out of the loop and make it completely autonomous. And you'll all be aware, just from the general news, the costs associated with building a nuclear submarine. I mean, it runs into the billions of pounds. And yet you can take an unmanned system, its ability to go to sea and detect and contribute to a picture and understanding of what the enemy may be up to. Well, you can do all that in an unmanned system for a fraction of the cost. The Americans have placed a contract for one, but after the Americans, really, we are at the lead. And that, again, is being done down by us in Plymouth. And that's very, very exciting to have something that you can carry around in a frigate or destroyer or an amphibious ship and then just lower over the side, and it can go off and hopefully find a submarine by itself or do reconnaissance of the beach, understand the gradient, whether there are mines there. You can put a mast up then and start looking for enemy activity. So if you're getting enemy radars or communications, you can pick all that up. So all that can be done at range safely without putting anyone at risk. You then bring that system back and you have all that information. So that's where we're hoping to go with that. We also build a dry submarine. So when I say dry submarine, it's you sit inside and you remain dry for the US Special Forces, for the Navy SEALs. So I'm very proud of the fact that the delivery system for the SEALs, obviously quite well known as a brand, is made not in America, but it's made in Plymouth. So to give you a bit of context, the Americans tried, as you'd expect with the Americans, to build their own system. They spent in excess of $1 billion, and they had one platform that subsequently caught fire and didn't go to sea. They tried again, didn't get past the design stage, and put it out to contract. We already had a relationship with SOCOM, Special Operations Command, so we bid for the contract, and we won. This is built in Plymouth, it was tested in Plymouth, and now in service with the US. And what you're looking at there is a 29-ton, 12.5-metre long submarine. Divided into three, you carry a certain amount of divers in the front. In the middle there is a lockout chamber. So there's a hatch that opens, but inside then the guys, they come out the hatch, they go off and do whatever they're required to do and come back. So pretty much every other Navy Special Forces community in the world, including ours, uses a wet system, which is really just an upgrade of the old World War II chariots. So the guys are on air, breathing from their air, strapped into something with very little situational awareness, limited to 30 metres, your normal subaqua depth, and really in quite an uncomfortable place, and with a very limited duration in terms of how far you can go. With these systems, and although the actual parameters are classified, we're talking days, hundreds of metres, and hundreds of miles. So it's a completely different way of getting your forces into the right place to have an effect than the system that everyone else in the world uses. Just to give you some sense of price, they're about 30 million pounds each, which sounds a lot of money, but for the capability that it brings, isn't that much money, and it's not much more expensive than the wet system. So in the future, if you hear, and obviously there's a lot going on at the moment of the SEALs being delivered ashore somewhere to go and do something, hopefully for good, it could well come from a system that's made just down the road in Plymouth. The other thing we have done is made the largest unmanned submarine in the world. This is a 24-metre submarine. It's designed for the Americans. It was designed to look and behave like an Iranian coastal submarine used by Iran and North Korea, so two potential adversaries there. These are really horrible submarines. As someone who commanded an anti-submarine frigate and spent my time looking for little submarines, these things are incredibly difficult to find. They can operate in really, really shallow water where it's very, very noisy. They can really ruin your day. So the Americans asked for someone to build a training one that they could then go and send their forces out, whether that's in a maritime patrol aircraft, whether it's in a helicopter or a frigate, to go and train against. And we won the contract. And here's a picture of one in a secret lake in Ohio, as much as you can have a secret lake, but a secret test facility. And that's the future. So we've taken that now, and this is where we're going. You're not going to put anyone in harm's way. You can send these vessels out. They can stay at sea for months with a mixture of diesel batteries and fuel cells. You can put pretty much the same sensor fit on as you can do a conventional submarine, but the cost is a fraction. So in terms of getting enough systems in a particular part of water to have an effect, you can do this pretty effectively. And by keeping them unarmed, you do away with the whole wider issues of a man in the loop for an engagement. So providing you keep your torpedoes safely in a helicopter, a maritime patrol aircraft, another ship, or potentially another submarine, and actually all you do is use these things to find your enemy, then you know, it steers us clear of some quite controversial areas of discussion, which we will have to come to at some stage, because the Russians and Chinese are arming their unmanned vessels. So if we foresee a situation where we could go up against one of these countries in the future, and our systems are unmanned because as a society we are uncomfortable about manning drones, and the enemy, for good or bad, has got past that as an issue, then we're going to lose. So that's an interesting thing for us to sort of to cogitate over in the future. They are completely autonomous. The debate is, what does the submarine do when it finds something? Or more interestingly, what does it do when it finds something that it wasn't told to do? So to go back to Lawrence of Arabia, he had this expression, this kingfisher moment. Within warfare, you had this flash of brilliance, this flash of opportunity, where you, as someone relatively junior, could do something that would change the outcome of the battle. If you have an unmanned system, and for example, you're telling it to go up and down the beach and look for mines, and actually out of the port sails the enemy's aircraft carrier. Now, for a manned submarine, what you would do is obvious. You would stop what you were doing and you'd go and trail the enemy aircraft carrier. How does an autonomous system deal with that level of complexity? How clever does it have to be? Such that its situational awareness has taken in the fact that I've just picked up an acoustic signature of something which in my threat library, because of the type of propeller, I believe is to be hostile. Yeah, where does the decision making come in? And in that sense, we would probably program into the submarine anything that comes up that's unusual, then you come to the surface and communicate and ask for direction. It's a very interesting field. Now, I mean, that's a military example, but of course, you know, there are dozens of more peaceful ones.
So here we have a Plymouth-based company with impeccable credentials at the very forefront of technological innovation. There will be no human skipper or crew on board. The Mayflower autonomous ship would follow the same route across the Atlantic Ocean as its sailing predecessor 400 years ago. The craft is a trimaran, 15 metres long and made of aluminium. It will be driven by an electric motor, which will be fed from batteries charged by solar energy, with a diesel generator to top up the charge if needed. At the heart of the boat will be a powerful computer running an artificial intelligence program, which will make all the decisions on board without human intervention. Radar would detect hazards at a range of 2.5 miles. Cameras would then be used to identify the hazard. What is a cargo vessel, a fishing boat, or even a partially submerged shipping container? AIS would supply information about the hazard's location, course and speed. GPS would provide Mayflower's location, course and speed. Other data would be captured. Weather reports, attitude sensors giving pitch and roll, a depth sounder and a vessel management system would keep an eye on battery state, power consumption, communications and the various scientific experiments on board. All this data will be fed into the onboard AI system. There is no remote control. No one will be steering the boat from a master control centre ashore. Once it slips its mooring in Plymouth, it's on its own, right up until the time it docks in Massachusetts. But, as Paddy Dowsett pointed out, the maritime world is not known for its readiness to embrace new technology.
Bizarrely, although we are the slowest industry, if you like, if you think of a vessel going along at 12, 15 knots, you would have thought that would lend itself, or we would lend ourselves to sort of embracing autonomy, because what can go wrong when you're going at those sort of slow speeds concerned with 500 knots in the air or 70 miles an hour, and obviously twice that closing speeds on the surface. But for all that, we are the least forward-leaning industry in terms of autonomy. But that is changing.
And changing in a significant way. One of the giants of the computer world is on board.
We have attracted the attention of IBM. So you may have heard of their Watson, the autonomy program, which was already being fielded in the medical and legal world. We have formed an offshoot company with them that's going to develop the maritime part of Captain Watson. So they're interested in us because as part of our development, the Mayflower and other stuff, we've set up a number of very, very straightforward, I'd like to say data capture points around Plymouth Sound, but that sort of makes it sound more grand than it is. A series of cameras and radars, one on the edge of Mountbatten Pier, if you're familiar with that. Some more on the Breakwater Fort, which is MOD property, but we struck a deal. So what we've been doing over the last couple of years is just collecting data on boats, and then using that to feed the machine. So we're teaching machines to recognize vessels. So there are lots of companies writing the clever algorithms, but there aren't many companies, in fact there aren't any in the maritime, that's actually collecting the food, for want of a better term, to feed the machines, to teach the machine to recognize a boat. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is then, okay, you recognize as a boat, what can we do now? Well, we can develop software that is COLREG compliant. So if you look at autonomous ships at sea at the moment that claim to be all road compliant, they are in the spirit of it, in the fact that it will be able to identify there is something at a certain range and bearing that they don't want to hit, and therefore will effectively put a bubble around that in the same way as an autonomous system on a road will do, and steer clear of it. But it won't steer clear of it as expected by the COLREGs. Once you're not just seeing an object, you're seeing a vessel under sail, a vessel engaged in trawling, a powdering vessel constrained by its draft. And obviously it takes a lot of effort to be able to recognise something to that level. But once you do that, you can then conduct a manoeuvre that the master of that vessel will be expecting you to take because it's in accordance with the rules. So this is, again, is a bit of a game changer. It's a very complicated thing to do, but actually it allows us to develop what we call rules of the road compliant software, which is something else we think no one else is doing that at the moment. We're almost ready to take that to sea. And what we're doing in the first instance is putting that on manned vessels. So that level of awareness, that machine learning, isn't just for unmanned systems. So we've got two trials we're about to put in place. One hopefully with the Royal Marines and their landing craft, and one with Plymouth Marine Laboratories, their boats in the Sound. Is that the machine, when it's done this, when it's looked at the sort of the picture, taking in all the images from AIS, radar and its cameras and worked out what to do, obviously in a completely autonomous machine, it would then just give some form of instruction to turn left, increase speed, whatever. But you can vocalise that, so it can come out as a recommendation. So Captain Watson recommends, given the yacht at 3-0, you turn to starboard 15 degrees, open out the CP8 or whatever. So that can provide a check. For us, then, if we do that with a learned skipper, then it gives us some degree of confidence that actually what Captain Watson is coming out with is realistic and sensible. But once we've achieved the right level of maturity and we're happy with it, you can have that in all sorts of situations. I mean, you think, obviously you're all very aware of the rules of the road, but you think of fishermen as probably being one of the least informed communities. If you have something that's telling the skipper of the fishing boat, you are required to give way. Because a fishing boat thinks, as long as it's got its thing up in the front, irrespective of whether it's got nets out or not, it has some form of privilege over everything else, which of course is far from the case. You know, you can help manned communities as well. Even on sailing boats, if you're single-handed or you've got a short crew, small crew, and there's a lot going on, to have something that can inform you of an approaching situation, just to attract your attention, I would suggest it is useful. And we all know on these long-distance, single-handed dock races, people sleep. They don't obey the rules of the road. How can they? Because they've got their head down, albeit for a short amount of time. So all this sort of stuff is not just for fully autonomous vessels. There's a human element to it as well. And you're absolutely right, sir. We hope to be at the van of the market for that. But that's almost grown out of the Mayflower. Once we started to look at the challenges that faced us with building the Mayflower and getting it safely, we started to look at this stuff in detail, putting up these data capture points, having conversations. And then one almost chance conversation with IBM said, actually, we're really interested in that. Can we come and help you? So. The UK is playing catch-up, but over the last 2 to 3 years, the Department for Transport has established a maritime autonomy unit, and then through the MCA, there's this regulation and authority working group to try and set the scene, really. Because with any new technology, the law always lags, doesn't it? If you waited for the IMO and the MCA to set up rules, then you'd be waiting forever. And of course, until something gets out there, and we start to understand the envelope, there is very limited legislation you can write. So we've had the Dr. Katrina Kemp, who's head of the MCA's autonomy unit, down for a chat just before Christmas, and they want to use the Mayflower as a test case. So they're very forward-leaning. They want to make sure the UK stays at the van of this sort of stuff. So it's definitely a case of, no, you're not doing that until we understand it, is that we need things like this to help us understand it and then set the parameters. But as you will appreciate, once you cross your territorial waters and you're in international waters, then you're dealing with the IMO. And the IMO, like most UN bodies, is quite slow in coming up with legislation. The Maritime Security Committee has been tasked with looking at autonomy and is making changes a recommendation. And of course, autonomy, the first thing one would really need to do is agree the lexicon. What do you mean when you say autonomy? Because it's one of these words that probably means different things to different people. And you could have autonomy in the engine rooms, you could have autonomy on the bridge, you could conceive of some form of cargo bulk carrier that is fully automated down below and could be pretty heavily automated on the bridge. So if you have got long ocean passages, do you need to have anyone on board? But as you start to approach some of the choke points, whether it's a Bab el-Mandeb, the Straits of Hormuz, the Malaccan Straits, the Dover Straits, put a team on board. And obviously ships do that now, but for security reasons, if you're in sort of pirate-infested waters, as you start to approach those waters, the vessel slows down, you bring on your anti-piracy team. Well, you could do exactly the same thing, but with your bridge team. What constitutes autonomy really needs to be defined, and then we need to have a discussion about whether the IMO rules actually stop you from doing anything, and some of the other rules as well. So, yeah, the coal regs will lay out what constitutes a safe speed, what constitutes a proper lookout, and all the other bits and pieces. But nowhere does it say that the master has to be on board. And it doesn't. So if you're a lawyer, you will pick up on that. Now, one lawyer will say, yes, but of course, when those rules are written, it was implicit that the master was going to be on board. Where else was it going to be? And another lawyer will say, yeah, but it doesn't say that, so I can do it. So so the lawyers love this because this is years and years of work for them. And again, if you read, is it Cockcroft and Lammiger? One of the Royal Road books. I don't know whether any of you have it. I remember buying it when I was on my Navigator's course. It's 45, 50 quid. It's a lot of money for a book. But it gives you all the test cases. And that's why the rules can seem so ambiguous at times. It's because there's a lot of grey. And there's even a rule that says, and if you don't think any of these rules apply and you need to do something else, do it. You know, so there's lots of ways of getting out of the rules, which is fantastic. So when any maritime case goes to court that involves a collision, there's always a percentage of apportionment of blame. No one party is ever completely innocent. You share the blame because there's that bit in the rule said, look, if it's all going horribly wrong, do what you need to do to avoid a collision. And you should have made that in time to avoid a collision. So, you know, you're hoisted by your own petard. So that's why this is such an interesting area for lawyers. And the City of London is catching on to this and actually now quite forward-leaning. So irrespective of the state of our shipbuilding industry, you know, the City and the Port of London has remained a hub of maritime activity, whether that's sort of trading through the Baltic Exchange, whether that's through Lloyd's Registry and all the other underwriters and everything else. And so the City is very much trying to make sure that it doesn't go, this is all far too difficult, we're not getting involved, but trying to understand where the risks are and staying up with legislation. So, and of course, insurance is a big part of this. If you're going to build a vessel that's going to sea for the purpose of moving cargo around and making money, then it has to be insured, doesn't it? So before you can insure, it has to be classed. Probably you don't deal with class societies with the sort of vessels you have, but you deal with classification through the MCA. But a vessel has to be classed. And so a class society, whether it's Lloyd's or DNVGL or or Bureau Veritas, the French ones, or the American Bureau, whichever one you use, will obviously have a large say in the design of that vessel, which when it was a traditional vessel, that's fine. When you're bringing autonomy on board, so you're having autonomy making the decisions, who owns that risk? And it's exactly the same conversation that we see in the newspaper all the time with cars. If your autonomous car crashes, whose fault is it? Who's going to wear the blame, the liability, which obviously when you're carrying cargo around is measured in potentially millions of pounds of loss of revenue. Is it the class society that said, yes, we like this type of ship? Is it the person that wrote the autonomous software? Is it still the master who should be at least observing the autonomous vessels occasionally, particularly when they come into areas of congested waterways where something could go wrong? Where does the blame lie? Who's going to be hauled up in front of the courts to be found guilty so the insurers can then divvy up the spoils or get their money back? So that's one of the big issues that has really, to an extent, act as a bit of a blocker with developing this stuff. The other thing is the nature of the industry. You know, a lot of the guys move ashore. So they start off, they get their tickets, perhaps some of them become pilots, and then they move ashore, and then they sort of occupy the positions of authority. Some of them find it very, very difficult to accept that an unmanned vessel could do the job better than them, which is interesting because that perspective is 180 degrees out from the aviation world, which obviously has a very short history, but a history of embracing technology to improve safety. If you make any difficult approach now, if you're sat in the back of an aeroplane that makes an approach to a difficult airport, they will be hands off. Whereas our view as mariner, there's no new machine that could get my ship into Plymouth Harbour as well as I could do. That's nonsense, you know, and we'll be hands on. That's just the mindset. So when you're overcoming those human factors, that's one of the reasons why the industry has been perhaps slower than others, despite my opening comment about we're only doing 12, 15 knots. I think the American Coast Guard, for a while, had a view that any autonomous vessel should have some form of AIS code that identified it as autonomous. But why? Because actually, the level of professionalism captured and embodied in that level of autonomy is probably higher than most of the other vessels around it. So why do you need it? It has no special... If it's obeying the rules, it has no special condition. It's not privileged. It's not constrained by its draft. It's not engaged in towing. You list whatever it is. You're sailing, you're engaged in fishing, launching and recovering of aircraft, mine cannon. None of those conditions that give you a form of privilege over another vessel apply. I'm sure you're also familiar with VHF assisted collisions. I used to, again, without spinning dicks, when I was captain, I used to ban my junior officers from using VHF. There's no reason to use VHF if faced with a normal shipping situation. Because even if it's not obeying the rules, then the rules put an onus on you to understand that he's not obeying the rules and respond accordingly. So what, other than giving him a bollocking, what is the utility of VHF in a rule road situation? So yes, understanding how you build in VHF to your level of awareness is one thing. But I'm more concerned about lookout, sound signals. Again, hopefully this happened on every ship. But when you entered restricted visibility and you reduce your speed and you started making sound signals and you increase the watertight integrity, and for us, you know, with two engines and you're obliged to bring both your engines online to give you additional, all those sort of things that the rules encourage you to do, we also used to open the bridge wing doors and post lookouts, because then being able to detect a sound signal was obviously something that you're expected to do. So I think that responding to sound signals is more of a challenge, or as much as a challenge, to an autonomous vessel as it is being able to respond to VHF, which is grossly abused in my experience.
Some interesting concepts to ponder there, and I think everyone would agree about the abuse of VHF. You only need a day in the Solent to confirm that. Accepting the concept of an autonomous ship requires us to reevaluate some of the basic concepts which are ingrained in us as mariners. Many questions are posed. For instance, can a computer-controlled boat be as safe as one with a human skipper on board?
Most accidents, whether they're sort of berthing in the approaches or otherwise, are caused by human error. The autonomous ship is very, very capable of berthing itself with just as great a degree of accuracy as a manned vessel's. with, I would suggest, some form of network to support it. So, you know, we will instinctively pick up a transit as we come in. We will look at the tidal stream on a buoy. If there's something fluttering in the wind, we will take that sort of, that level of detail in, and hopefully, you know, work that into our approach to a berth, whether we're being set on or off it, and all that sort of stuff. So, in that sense, what we need probably is some form of instrumentation of the water space, such that the autonomous system knows what the tidal stream is doing on the approach to the berth, what the wind is doing. It's amazing, isn't it? You know, you look down as you pass a buoy. So being able to take that data in and apply it to your subsequent manoeuvres is something the human brain does quite naturally. So I think that's probably where we need to do a little bit more work to make sure our autonomous skipper can behave as effectively as a... Again, you know, as someone who observed human watchkeepers over a long period of time and ultimately sort of sat in my chair, sat on my thumbs trying to not say anything, I would see very, very gifted young officers come in, execute a manoeuvre, whether it's coming alongside, whether it was refuelling, going through the checks and launch helicopter, flawlessly. And then every now and again, it would go horribly wrong. And you just think, why this time? You know, what's happened to you that you've put the ship at risk or done something that could have led to an incident at some stage this time, where the other 99 times it's gone right? And of course, with an autonomous system, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be better than the human. And I think, by and large, they are.
And that is an uncomfortable concept for some, that a machine, a computer linked to a boat, is better, more precise, less accident-prone than a human skipper.
Now, so what we could see off a busy port is that you have autonomous vessels that come to the fairway buoy. There's some form of data communication with the port, X amount of hours out, they get assigned an anchorage, they go to the anchorage, they anchor by themselves, that's fine. You know, we have autonomous tugs now, we have sort of magnetic couplings to allow a tug to connect to a ship without the use of wires and ropes, which obviously would normally require some form of human invention. There's a lot of work going into magnetic jetties, so actually you secure alongside it. Yeah, I think we've all come across one of those, haven't we? So actually, your vessel just goes to harbour, so it just goes to anchor somewhere, and then the pilot comes out with his team and then is on board to provide that level of assurance for the final stage. But of course, fast forward 20 years, where have your pilots come from? You know, it's like now, if you think of the aeroplane analogy again, you've got two young aviators whose career has been spent hands-off, actually. Do you want them putting their hands back on when it all starts to go horribly wrong? Because their ability to intervene meaningfully reduces over time because they haven't had the experience literally holding that thing at all, have they? And I think we've already seen a number of aviation instances where the guys didn't understand the system well enough. And I will go back to another swinging the lamp. You know, I spent years drawing up paper charts. I think the rule of thumb is like 2 hours. Is it 2 hours? Preparation on a chart for 1 hour of execution. It could have been even more than that for me because I was rubbish. But in doing so, you understood, you formed a relationship with that chart when you're coming into harbour, didn't you? So you looked at, you got your pilot out, you got your amateur list of lights and radio signals, you drew up your notebook. So actually, you had absorbed a lot of the information necessary for a safe entry before you got to that fairway buoy, because you'd done that work. You had to lean into the chart to take that data out, put it in your notebook, look at the light so you knew where it was going to be. The young boys and girls know electronic charts, it's like your sat-nav. You know, you just put a series of crosses, it prints it all off, and they got it. So it takes them 10, 15 minutes to produce their pilotage plan, but they haven't absorbed any knowledge. So they stand there in front of the Polaris, and they're desperately trying to make their printed off GPS electronic chart generated, you know, pilotage plan fit. So there is a danger, I think, in this transition from manned to unmanned systems, but where we still expect a man or woman to come back into the loop, what are they going to add? And I know it's something, again, the City of London are looking at in terms of what does a mariner of the future look like? Every country is struggling to recruit mariners. Now, mariners are pretty average people, I understand, and I remember a master mariner telling me this once, and he was right. You know, people who run away to join the sea, whether it's the Royal Navy or the Merchant Navy, are your sort of middle-of-the-road sort of people but with a sense of adventure. And I would definitely put myself in as that category. But getting youngsters to go to sea now just is not appealing in the way that it was when I joined up and before. And of course, the pressures on both the Merchant Marine and the Royal Navies, you don't have these fantastic runs ashore anymore. You know, you're in on one high tide, you offload, and then you're gone again. And that period in port, you're getting ready, you're overseeing the cargo, you're checking the stability. You know, you can have the captain, the chief officer, and then a couple of junior watchkeepers, so you're one in three, you're permanently tired. Who wants to go to sea and do that for not a large amount of money? So what autonomy could do is change the nature of being a seafarer, where perhaps you do one or two deployments to understand the environment, and then you move ashore and work in some form of remote control station where you're monitoring the equipment. If you think about that, again, that's where the aviation industry are. You know, if you look at a Rolls-Royce engine, the monitoring of the performance of the engine when it's airborne is, yes, the crew of the airplane are looking at it, but Rolls-Royce control centers are looking at it, aren't they? So when the aircraft went missing a couple of years ago, the famous one, the last known position of that aircraft didn't come from the cockpit, it came from the GPS embedded in the engine monitoring system. So in the aviation industry, there's already off-board monitoring of onboard equipment. And again, that's another way the maritime industry is going to go. All your pumps and everything else are going to be stop-started. And with the advent of 3D printing, if something is starting to fail at sea now, you turn it off and you print the part, and then when you get alongside, you put the printed part on, and then you're ready to go again. So lots of changes coming.
We are clearly at the very early stages of significant and fundamental changes in the way that ships operate at sea. But one member of the audience wanted to know whether the Mayflower autonomous ship would also be monitored from on land and could control be seized in an emergency. If all was going well, would the ship, for instance, be sending a "I'm OK" message back to base?
Yes. We will have the ability to monitor it remotely, and it'll send "I'm fine, thanks," and that can be a text now, so you don't even have to be at a screen. You know, that can come in, and you get your ops normal report by text, and then if it encounters something that requires human intervention, then you can go and log on to any terminal anywhere, because it's all over the internet, and then see what's going wrong. I've had a falling out with my MD over Mayflower about the requirement to preserve life, to contribute to a search and rescue. So my view is the Mayflower should have a life raft on board and be able to deploy that life raft, because there's nothing to say that we're out at sea or relatively close in, and you are the first vessel that happens to pass a sinking fishing vessel or some other vessel, some other form of distress. Why should you not be able to respond? As a mariner, I feel very strongly about that even if your vessel's unmanned, there is a man in the loop somewhere back monitoring it, and you're still a member of that community, albeit you're fulfilling your responsibilities in a different way. So if you think about the communication systems you will have on board and the ability to generate situational awareness through perhaps additional cameras and backup radars and satellite connectivity to support the autonomy or remote control, that actually makes you a pretty effective on scene first incident, whatever it is, to give that situational awareness back to the coordination, the rescue coordination center. And if you could do that, so you're on scene, you know, you can see what the autonomous vessel is seeing, you've got cameras there, and you can act as a beacon for the subsequent rescue effort, because the search bit you have done with by being in the right place, so you know where the people are, and you can deploy a life raft, then I think there is a sense of duty that we should look to give our autonomous vessels that capability. Looking to the future, why do we have autonomous lifeboats? Because if you think every time you put a lifeboat to sea, you have gone through a calculus. You are taking risk with the crew of that lifeboat to go and rescue the crew of the stricken vessel. And there's been a number of horrible Penlee incidents where that hasn't worked out. But of course, if you're sending an autonomous vessel out there, there is no risk. You're talking about some GRP and some boxes and a bit of fuel. So, yes, you've got to deal with how do you actually get these people on board then, if there's no burly lifeboatmen to reach down and pull them up. But actually, you can take more risk and perhaps save more people because you're not taking risk with human life. It can only ever work out well.
Now there's a thought, an autonomous lifeboat. Some will scoff, but it will come. But returning to the Mayflower, one member of the audience wondered if it was vulnerable to piracy. Could it be subject to a cyber attack? Paddy Dowsett warned that weaknesses in computer systems can be exploited through the most unlikely and obscure ways.
So there was a casino shoreside that was robbed electronically. They got in through the fish tank thermometer, which is connected to the Internet of Things. When we start designing autonomous ships from the outset, I would suggest that cyber is less of an issue because you're taking the man out of the loop and the system is designed to be robust. It's where we've got current systems that has a man in the loop, or in the casino thing where you've got so many things connected to the Internet of Things and we don't understand it, that's where we're most vulnerable. Obviously, you've got state hackers that have the ability to get through the most robust of cyber walls, but that's the case now, isn't it? You know, there's a cyber war going on that's only just under the radar. And there's even a view that I picked up recently that cyber will make nuclear weapons obsolete. You know, you can shut down a country now through cyber. You have no need to resort to the threat of a nuclear exchange. You can bring a country to its knees within days. You can interfere with your supply chain. You can shut down your hospitals. You can shut down your banks. You can shut down all your government organizations. You can turn off the traffic lights. You can turn off power.
A chilling thought, but that's the reality of the connected world in which we live. Another questioner wondered how a crew of two sailing the Atlantic would fare in the path of an autonomous vessel.
Well, I'm back to, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it will be better than the human. So I think the odds of bumping into a two-man small yacht in the middle of the Atlantic are pretty remote. And obviously, out of those two men, one of them will be up maintaining a proper watch and lookout as required by the rules, I'm sure. So if vessels big enough to cross the Atlantic, it'll probably be big enough to be detected on radar or by camera.
Another member of the audience was concerned that he couldn't call up the Mayflower on VHF. Of course, there will be no one to talk to on board, but he explained he found it reassuring to be able to talk to the bridge of a passing ship. Could not the Mayflower be provided with a VHF facility to provide him and others with reassurance, he asked.
What, to provide reassurance to a less experienced mariner? No. No, to be serious for a moment, rather than for my flippant response, no, there's not, and we're looking at it. But this is very much pioneering, so some of these things will come out. But I was explaining this to some of the IBM guys. It is not as straightforward as applying the rules, and I think that the situation that illustrates it best is approach to a traffic separation scheme. So if you're coming up, Russian, and then going into the Dover traffic separation scheme, the experienced master mariners will almost have some form of collective consciousness about lining themselves up, giving every other mariner the right amount of space, adjusting the speed slightly, so you all line yourself up and get into the right one. And if you see a large vessel coming in that may be on a pretty steady CPA or with a CPA of a couple of cables, you know that that's going to change as he slots into place and he's just come up to it. And so you're collectively making sure all the ships are there. Again, with the crossing ones, you may have a ferry who's on a steady bearing coming crossing at 30 odd knots, but you know he's going to pass astern of you. And actually, although from an AI system that looks like a collision, you know it's not going to be a collision. You have some understanding, limited, absolutely, that the fishing vessel that's just zigzagging all the way across the traffic separation scheme will be partly driven by the flooding tidal stream to keep its nets open. And so you can have some guess. We're into guesswork here, where he's going to go based on the strength and direction of the tidal stream and its aspect. And the fact he's never really going to be doing more than sort of 4 or 5 knots, and so you've got time. So there's a level of consciousness that experienced mariners have that sit above being able to apply the rules of the road as required by the coal regs. And it's developing that next level of awareness is the challenge. Now, I got asked nicely but quite pointedly by some of the IBM guys who are visiting that. Effectively, we use the same logarithm, or we're using similar logarithm, to the banking system. So if you apply for a credit card or to get your phone updated, there's no human intervention to that process now. It's all run through a logarithm. But the logarithm is signed off by the very senior members of the bank. So if it goes wrong, there's someone's name and a signature somewhere that can be blamed for it and then given a bonus and retired. Within MSUBS, that guy's me at the moment, and I feel a little vulnerable about that because, you know, I'm a slightly out of date, no civilian qualification. So we do need to validate a lot of what we're doing, and we've approached the Marine Incident Accident Board to have a look at what we're doing, and other people to make sure that what we're teaching the machine is the right thing, because understanding how a machine is learning is still a bit of a dark art. How do we know the AI is learning the right lessons? And how do we get it to that level of consciousness that actually it can deal with what to a machine would be a very complicated system, lining yourself up into a busy traffic separation scheme, but to an experienced man, I would feel very much at ease because he knows what everyone's doing, with the exception of the fisherman.
And as we all know, fishing boats tend to operate on their own personal coal regs. One questioner wondered how the Mayflower would get its regular weather forecasts.
Yeah, so IBM have a very comprehensive weather satellite network, and selling weather is one of their business lines. So we're going to use their understanding of the weather and their forecasting to route around it. IBM see the commercial opportunities here. I think the military market will be quite niche. In this application, will be quite niche. I said we're talking with the Royal Marines to put it on their landing craft because, you know, their landing craftsmen, although they've done courses, wouldn't consider themselves as natural mariners. So we see that as one application, but it's far more the commercial sector, both so providing advice to manned vessels and then potentially unmanned ones as well in the future. Yeah.
The Mayflower is due to sail from Plymouth in September. It's a trimaran and the hulls have arrived from Poland and are now being fitted out in MSUB's workshops in Plymouth. Trials are due to start soon, and if all goes to plan, the Mayflower autonomous ship will leave Plymouth and cross the Atlantic, docking in Plymouth, Massachusetts, about a fortnight later. One member of the audience wondered if it will slip its mooring and pilot itself out of Plymouth Sound totally unaided.
Good question, and we're working on that. We would like to see it slip from the berth and be autonomous there on it. And of course, you can play tunes on that. You can have a loose line to a tug, such that if it does start to go wrong, then you can bring it back under control quite perfectly. As you'll be aware, there's a part of the water space there that is controlled by the Queen's Harbour Master. You know, and he's backed up by an Act of Parliament. So if he says, you're not coming through my turf unless you've got this on a loose line tow, then we're not going through his turf. He happens to be an old Navy colleague of mine, so I'm working on that. But I think, and he's forward-leaning, he wants to. You can choose a quiet day to sail clear of any sort of heavy traffic and between the sort of, you know, the inshore yacht racing and everything else. But of course, the moment you say the Mayflower sailing on this day, then we're probably going to generate our own level of traffic. So, I suspect we won't have the authority to sail completely autonomously.
But if loose lines to a tug are deployed but not used, then it's as good as being under autonomous control. But what happens when it arrives in Plymouth, Massachusetts? What sort of reception can it expect?
Are engaged with Plymouth, Massachusetts, and at the moment they've got a plan to sail their old Mayflower, which is seaworthy, out to meet it, and the two of them go back in, which if that happened would be quite impressive. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to them.
Imagine that, a replica of the original Mayflower escorting the 21st century Mayflower after it had crossed the Atlantic under autonomous control. Quite a sight. The Mayflower autonomous ship will be undergoing trials in Plymouth Sound and is due to sail to Plymouth, Massachusetts in late September. The talk was fascinating and opened a window on the future of shipping and revealed the impact automation will eventually have on our own time at sea. The assembled audience of Southwest Section members was truly impressed by the evening, and the talk opened up a whole new maritime world we never knew existed. There's also one other secret to be revealed. The Mayflower autonomous ship will carry a C.A. Burgee, which will be presented to the Commodore of the Plymouth Yacht Club in Massachusetts. Paddy Dowsett had captured our imagination and opened our eyes to the future. We will be sharing the waters in which we sail with autonomous craft, and it's happening faster than one might have imagined. We thanked him for a fascinating talk and wish him every success with the project, which we will be following very closely on the internet.
Thank you.